Hello and welcome to Bowery Poetry Speaks, an audio series of talks and performances from our special Bowery perspective. At Bowery, we start every event with an Honor Native Land statement. We would like to acknowledge that Bowery Poetry Club rests on the traditional lands and waters of the Lenape people, and we give respect to the Lenape and their elders past, present, and future by speaking in the Lenape language, Anushik, which means thank you and welcome. Anushik.
Welcome to Traffic Europe Radio. I'm your host, Joe Williams, and today I'm talking to Philip Roughton, a translator from Icelandic. Hello, Philip. It's very nice to speak to you.
Hello, nice to speak to you also.
We've got quite a lot to talk about, including your most recent translations of Icelandic literature, which are now available, which have been published in 2022, including Salkavalga by Eldor Laxness and Caritas by Kristín Maria. Before we get into the specific works, could I just please ask you to introduce yourself to us and explain your background, please?
Yeah, I'm Phil Roughton, and originally I was born in St. Louis, Missouri, but I grew up in Colorado, did all my schooling in Colorado, have degrees in comparative literature, and I studied languages like Icelandic, Chinese, Latin, and a few others along the way too, Arabic and Russian. And so language has always been my main interest and strong point and joy, I guess you could say. And then as I was doing my master's degree and then my doctoral degree at Colorado, I got grants to go over and study in Iceland. And so I was over there in Reykjavik studying medieval literature and doing research on medieval manuscripts in saints' lives and things like that. And then to learn Icelandic better, I started translating. And then I got more and more translation work. And so I switched over to that full time. But my background is in language literature. And I used to teach literature also at Colorado and here too in Iceland.
Wonderful. Yeah. As most, a lot of our listeners will know, Iceland has a reputation for being a highly literary society. The statistic that is very often batted about is that 1 in 10 Icelanders will publish a book within their lifetime. And there seems to be a deep love, a very deeply rooted love of literature in Icelandic culture and society, one that can trace its roots back very far to, of course, you know, the tradition of the sagas, the Icelandic sagas, which I would quite like to talk about a little bit. Before we do, what drew you to Iceland as a literary culture then? You've already talked about how your background is very much in language and literature. So it's quite obvious, it feels like quite a natural country and society to gravitate towards. But what was the specific reason you ended up gravitating towards Iceland?
I was studying, I always loved like old languages, and I started studying at Colorado, I started studying Old English, and this is a typical route to Iceland. People start with Old English and then move to Old Icelandic, and that's what I did. The professor who taught Old English at Colorado also had lived in Iceland in 1960 on a Fulbright grant. He was here doing folklore research, and he encouraged me to try to also get a Fulbright grant to come to Iceland. We had been working together on a project about these old Icelandic saints' lives, translations of Latin saints' lives into Icelandic. And so he taught me Old English, Old Icelandic, Modern Icelandic, and a lot of Icelandic folk songs and things like that, and then encouraged me to come to Iceland. And it worked out. I got a grant and I came. And so that's, yeah. It was basically my love of old obscure languages that brought me here in the first place.
Absolutely, yeah. And one interesting thing that I have learned, or at least have read, about Icelandic as a language, as you say, a very old language, and apparently there's still a very high degree of intelligibility in the sense that modern Icelandic speakers can read and understand a great deal of these ancient or these medieval Icelandic family sagas. Whereas a modern English speaker, if you look at something like Beowulf, you recognize the odd word. And you basically need a translator. And the journey from Anglo-Saxon to Middle English to Modern English is a story of kind of languages changing and mutating significantly. But there seems to be, as I understand it, a greater continuity between medieval Icelandic and modern Icelandic. Is that the case?
Yes, very much the case. Most Icelanders can pick up an old saga and understand most of it, whereas you can't do that with Old English and Modern English. But then, like Halldór Laxness, he wrote this novel called Gerpla, which I translated as Wayward Heroes. And in that, his sort of working method was, as he said, not to use any words that cannot have been proven to have been in use in the 12th century, I think. And so he was basically writing in an old Icelandic style, or at least modern Icelandic with a very archaic feel to it. And sometimes I thought, geez, the only person that could actually translate this book properly would be somebody like Thomas Hardy, who has really a command of beautiful older English than we have nowadays, most writers. Yeah, and it's funny, when I came here, I had been studying and translating these old ecclesiastical texts, these old saints' lives. And so my first year in Iceland, I remember a friend took me to a Salvation Army meeting. That comes up in Salkavalka. And that was actually the only place that I could really understand the language at first, because I was familiar with all that church language. But yeah, the Icelanders pride themselves on the fact that their language has hardly changed in 1,000 years, and they still use the old letters and things like this. I think it's not quite as understandable as people may think, but it's still far more understandable to a modern Icelander. I mean, old Icelandic than old English and modern English, or even middle English, which is also difficult.
Great, thank you. And yeah, you've brought up Halldór Laxness, who perhaps we can turn to now, because I understand he was also a translator. He translated into Icelandic, I understand, Ernest Hemingway, for example, and he may have also done something to modernize some of the Icelandic sagas, or to update and offer a version of those Icelandic sagas in a perhaps more accessible, modernized language. So he seems like a very interesting guy. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature in about 1955, I think it was. Could you perhaps introduce Halldór Laxness to our listeners who may not be very familiar with him and his role in Icelandic literature in general?
Yes, you bring up how his modernized versions of the Icelandic sagas. He was actually criticized heavily for that, because there are a lot of people who in Iceland, especially at the time that he was doing this, considered the old sagas sort of like untouchable. They were like the holy grail of Icelandic literature, and for him to modernize them was like sacrilege. But he was like that. He was an iconoclast. He was heavily critical of his own society, his own people, and wrote a lot of essays advocating social change, electrification of the countryside. He wrote about he wanted people to stop clearing their throats so loudly at theater performances and things like this. So he was quite a stickler a thorn in the side of Icelandic society. And he was also criticized for his sort of appropriation of individuals for his books. And so he's a great figure, a Nobel Prize winner. And nowadays he's ubiquitous. He's everywhere in Iceland and considered rightly the master of Icelandic literature, modern Icelandic literature. Whereas in his day, he was much more of a controversial figure. And he was also prosecuted for tax evasion because his political enemies wanted to get at him. So he's not just interesting as a great writer. He's interesting as a social figure and as having many different sides. His life spanned the 20th century. Born in 1902, died in 1998. As a young man, he wrote a couple of novels when he was very young. And he had sort of, as described in his biography by Halldór Guðmundsson, he had sort of an epiphany when he was younger. And he knew that he wanted to write for the world. And much of his life was spent making sure that his books were being translated into other languages, because he didn't want to be confined to Iceland's shores. And I consider him sort of like a banner bearer for translators because of all the work that he had to do to make sure that his books were translated, really getting with publishers and other translators and doing all that he to sort of broaden Icelandic literature's horizons. And he had his like idiosyncrasies as well. He's known for writing for the common man and for social justice. And there's a great quotation in Salka Valka. It's how she says she always wanted to give a drubbing to those who make themselves superior to others. And Laxness is writing about the common man, as say an Independent People or a novel like that is considered to be his hallmark. But he would also stay at the most expensive hotels in Europe. He drove a Jaguar, which you can go see at his house down in in Glyvrastein in the south of Iceland. And very interesting person. And his writing is no less interesting because to me, reading Halldór Laxness, it's like how it feels when you're traveling through the Icelandic countryside. Like almost everywhere you turn, there's something new and different, profound, something that might change your view of the world or of nature. It's like he has a little bit of everything in his writing, just like in his personality also. There's a bit of, it's absurd, profound, vile. I'm not saying Halldór Laxness was vile. Cynical, humorous, beautiful. And his writing is just infused with humor, like everywhere. It's like absurdity and grotesqueness and humor, and it's just wonderful. It's wonderful to read. It's very poetic also. He was inspired by some of the early modernist poets in Iceland, and you really see in his writing how poetry is so important to him. So that's the long and short of Laxness.
Sure, with such an expansive and influential career, you can't exactly sum them up in just a couple of words, can you? So let's talk a little bit about Salka Valka, because I understand we've got a passage we're going to hear you read of your translation from this, which is available now on Archipelago, which was published in 2022. Salka Valka is a sprawling coming-of-age story, if I'm correct. It's about 600 pages long and deals with a young woman's experiences of living in a fishing community in Iceland. Could you please expand on this a little bit and then feel free to introduce your reading?
Yeah, Salka Valka is kind of like a Bildungsroman, coming-of-age novel. Salka and her mother find themselves in this fishing village called Oseiri, traveling to Reykjavik, and then they stop in Oseiri and don't go on, mainly because the mother has no more money. And so the mother turns to the Salvation Army for sustenance, and Salka has to make her own way in the village, even though the village basically tries everything it can to silence her and make her as gray and unfantastic as the village is called. I think you have these idealists in the novel, Sigurlína, Salka's mother, and Arnaldur, who's Salka's love interest. And Sigurlína is devoted to the church and the Salvation Army. Arnaldur is devoted to socialist ideals and becomes a revolutionary. And opposed to them, you have Salka herself, who's often described in naturalistic terms, very much connected with nature and the weather, and also the person who's the most vile in the novel, Steinthor, who basically rapes Salka. He's also described in this sort of same terms, this nature, sort of nature and the weather, and they both say, Salka and Steinthor at some point, they both say, I am what I am. Whereas Arnaldur and Sigurlína are more connected with the paradigms that they turn to, you might say. An Icelandic scholar named Jón Yngvi Jóhannsson wrote about this and says that with Arnaldur and Sigurlína, you have something that Laxness describes as their devotion to the rock sem dir heims, which means the logic of the world, but it just means the systems by which society supports itself. And opposed to them, you have nature. And I think it's very interesting in Salka Valka, you have this sort of tension between the natural world and the human world, this social world. And Laxness playing with this in how he makes the birds communists and how Salka and Steinthor are like representations of nature in the, so I'm wandering and rambling now. But I think this one passage that I have here can demonstrate this. Great description of the natural world and of the sort of juxtaposition of the social systems with nature, and Salka in the middle of all of that. I'll just read this passage here. Okay. It's toward the end of the book when Arnaldr and Salka are walking together. It says, "The world was delightful and fair. The redness of sunset and dawn were still one in the sky and on the sea. They walked along the shore in the direction of Oxlatinder Peak, which rises steeply from the fjord, its upper slopes scree-covered between green strips where lambs grazed contentedly, and down below, sheer cliffs where the swell broke in the calm, as tranquilly as carefree breaths in sleep. They followed the paths of horses and cows on the lowland along the sea, the foreshore resounding with life, as birds of all sorts busied themselves with their own elections or rocked with dreamy grace on the gentle swell in the peace of the bright night. The thousand-winged tern let out its cold, sulky trills over the low Ness Eyri, communistic in its attitude towards stronger birds. At a glance, the bird life as a whole seemed to be in wonderful harmony, in spite of the various speculative ventures among certain of the birds and the capitalist blaze of color on the sea and in the sky. Of course the birds have laws like us, although they may not consist of so many paragraphs. The boy and the girl sat down on the grassy sandbank among yarrow, butterwort, and even bluebells. The grass grew young and blissful between washed white pebbles and withered seaweed that the surf had carried ashore at some time. Every frond of seaweed gave the soil its sap. That, too, was in the spirit of communism. Everything was so wonderfully communistic. Behind every little trifle was the hidden hand of the great universal Balshi. They sat across from each other in the grass, and the soft dark sheen in the reflections of the mountains called to mind both his eyes and hair, but she couldn't bring herself to say so. A group of eider ducks were busy in a small bay. Finally, a drake called to two ducks and headed with them out to sea. "Ooh, ooh," said the drake, uniting the two ducks each at its own edge of the widening angle of his wake. "Vorther, vorther," he said as he moved farther away. "Ooh, ooh, vorther, vorther," was heard from various directions at the same time. Passionate allurements, so full of enticements is life, both on land and at sea. The boy and the girl talked only about birds, and they saw nothing but them. Or to put it more correctly, the birds alone talked about nature. Their knees touched lightly now and then as they sat in the grass, but so slightly that neither found reason to act as if they noticed it. He regarded Salka's profile as she sat in the grass and looked out to sea. Anyone who might have thought to attribute grace and beauty to her must, at the same time, have rebelled against these concepts, the concepts behind these words, as they are commonly understood. She was ugly, but in her strong primal facial features dwelt all the merits of the salinity that is and always will be in seawater as long as it breaks against the shore. In her eyes and mouth dwelt all the heathendom and all the unostentatiousness of a land that was originally intended for spotted seals and the callous broad-winged gulls of the sea. Her laughter did not seek to fly away into unknown depths like music, but was fused with her body, firmly fixed and unable to come loose, almost entirely inelastic, a purely fleshly movement devoid of refinement and inspiration. It began without warning and stopped without subsiding, like a sudden, lustful pain. So there you have this. For me, when I read something like this, I just think, who writes like this? Only Locke says. It's wonderful, and it's funny, and it's beautiful. And I love this description of Salka as being having the unostentatiousness of the land, because this is completely opposed to that foul character, Steinthor, who's constantly bragging about he did this and did that in foreign countries. And when he says, "I am what I am," it's like some kind of braggadocio. Whereas with Salka, it's just, she is what she's just unostentatious. She's just herself. So just a fit girl trying to make her way in the world by cleaning fish, I guess.
Thank you. Thanks for that reading and for the context and the explanation. Just heard Philip Roughton reading for him from his translation of Haldor Laxness's Salka Valka, available now on Archipelago. What something that came across very clearly there was the poetic influence that you talked about. There's a definite kind of music, and he makes full use of certain kind of resources like alliteration and imagery to tell his story. And I wanted to ask, and you talked about the influence of modernist poetry on him, and I wanted to also ask, is there any relationship or sort of continuity between this book or Haldor's writing in general and the ancient traditions, the sagas, the Icelandic family sagas? Is there any kind of continuity or dialogue or conversation, or is he seeking to break away in any radical way from that? Or is it more a question of kind of continuity and discontinuity?
This particular novel, I don't really see any continuity between it and the earlier and the sagas, especially. You can see it really because the sagas themselves are not poetic. And they are this type of writing that I just described. There's nothing like it in the sagas. The sagas rarely, I think almost never, touch on nature, which is very interesting because Iceland is just a magnificent natural wonder world. And you would think maybe that the saga writers might occasionally say how nice the sky is or how nice those mountains look, but they never do. That wasn't their purpose. Whereas with Laxness here, he's definitely creating this world of juxtapositions between nature and man and commenting on the, I think Jane Smiley in her review of Salka Valka commented on how the idea that in Salka Valka, you see this theme of the personal and the political and how they can never really mesh. That may be why political systems fail, because personality gets in the way of ideal or ruins ideal. Salka Valka, I said it in Icelandic, nay, it's very different than the Icelandic sagas. Whereas a book like Wayward Heroes, you have a definite rewriting of an old saga, the saga of the Foster brothers. And that book and also the novel Iceland's Bell, which is dealing with the preservation of the old stories and the old manuscripts, they're very much written in saga style, especially, Iceland's Bell. It's very terse, concise, and very little description of nature. In fact, there's one scene in Iceland's Bell in which a character thinks about nature, and it struck me as very unusual in that novel. And I always remembered that passage, and I've quoted it before in a couple of other interviews, but it's a beautiful sentence. Solar gangur var nu orðin langur, en kulda þræsingar sem oft vit verða á útmánuðum, which means the sun's course had lengthened considerably, but cold winds blew as often do in the closing weeks of winter. And that's one of the very few descriptions of nature in Iceland's Bell. It's a very alliterative passage, and Salka Valka is completely different. So Salka Valka is really a modern novel in all the senses of the word, with its poetry and its politics and its social commentary. So,
sure, absolutely. Yeah, one potential kind of commonality which could be argued is, as I understand it, the sagas always feature a lot of heroic women, and the role of women in the sagas is quite modern, could be considered quite modern. And I suppose Salka Valka does something like this with, it's a coming of age story about women, which perhaps might be in some ways a kind of parallel. And perhaps this is me speaking as more or less of a layman of Icelandic literature, but did I detect a kenning in what you were talking about, the logic of the world? And you said basically that's a kind of like long-winded way of saying systems. So is that a kind of kenning? Is that device, for people who may not be familiar with that, that is a device that is used in a lot of old Germanic and Norse literature, where you substitute one word for a long phrase and you paraphrase what something is instead of saying the actual name for it. So I don't know if there's any instances of either of those in this book particular or throughout his work generally?
That's rock. It's in Icelandic, the phrase rock sem dir heims, which is not particular. It's not a kenning because it's not a poetic figure. A proper kenning is something like the steed of the sea or something like that for a ship. Or so rock sem dir heims. I think Laxness might have even invented that. It's just a new, but it's rock usually means the logic, and roksemd is like the logicism or something like that of the world. But and kennings, yeah, they're not really used very often in Laxness or in modern literature. You do get a lot of idioms because Icelandic is a very idiomatic language. It's one of the things that makes it difficult to learn properly because people use idioms so much. Like a foreigner is spoken of often as of Erlendri Bergi Brotin, which means hewn of foreign stone. So this is just a typical way of saying foreigner in Icelandic. And actually, when I was translating Iceland's Bell, I didn't really know that was just an idiom, and I translated it literally. But for Iceland's Bell, it works because that's like an archaic style. So that worked there, but maybe I would someday go back and look over that translation again and see where I missed other idioms. But it's interesting about this, the idea of Saga sort of as a saga hero, because the women in the Icelandic sagas are very interesting and known for their, many times, for their independence or their, even say the nurses and servant women often do things in the sagas that cause the activities, the plot to keep rolling along, like pretending that they don't know, that claiming, oh, I don't know what's going on with this guy who just killed somebody else, to just give him time to escape or something like that. They're very smart. But it's interesting because oftentimes they can be a bit tragic too. And I think the women in, say, Wayward Heroes are very interesting. If any young critics and scholars out there want to write about something in Wayward Heroes, write about the women figures, because they're the ones who keep that story going, whereas the heroes are lost in their own idealistic worlds. And Salka too, she reminds me of a character in a saga called Gunnlaug Saga, Wormtongue, in which there are these two warriors who are in a rivalry, and they're sort of fighting over this woman named Helga the Fair, I think she's called. And they end up killing each other. And in the end, Helga, at the very end of the saga, is the description of her left holding one of these heroes' cloaks. And she's just sitting there by herself, left with nothing but the cloak that this guy gave her. And Salka, in the end of the novel, here's a spoiler alert, she's left at the end of the novel holding a locket that Arnaldr gave her, a little portrait of him, and she's described as being very much alone, so helpless and lonely just with this locket. So in a sense, she's one of these tragic saga figures who are left by the wayside after all the heroic battles are done and finished, like with Arnaldr and his socialistic revolution. It's very interesting, actually, that sort of comparison.
Sure, thank you. Thank you for expounding on that. And yeah, I realised, yeah, perhaps it's not really a kenning, what I was speaking to before, because a crucial characteristic of a real kenning is that it's a poetic stand-in for an object, and the one you described perhaps isn't. I think the favourite one that I saw used as an example was the destroyers of eagle hunger as warriors. So the idea being that carrion birds will eat the bodies after a battle. So so it's one kenning buried in another kenning. So the original is kind of like twice removed, if you like, from the original thing. In that the original kenning was something like the satisfiers of carrion hunger, and then they become the destroyers of carrion hunger. It's all very elaborate and involved, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very, very complicated, sophisticated, and really shows that sort of ultra literary quality of the early Icelandic society. They're the ones who preserved all that medieval literature for Scandinavia, and the kennings occur mostly in the skaldic poetry, which is extraordinarily difficult to to comprehend and translate because of those cool kennings like you're talking about.
Okay, thank you. Let's talk then. Let's move away from Halldór Laxness and talk about another Icelandic author who you've also translated. I'm talking, of course, about Kristín Marja Baldursdóttir. And the most recent work of hers, which you have translated, is called Caritas Untitled, which is available now on Amazon Crossing. And here, again, we have another meaty book, another long book, again, with strong female protagonists. Why don't you introduce this author to us and explain how you first came across her work?
Kristín Marja is one of Iceland's most beloved, I think, writers, an inspiration to a lot of the younger generation of writers now. She published Caritas Untitled in 2004, and then a book called Chaos on Canvas, which is the sequel to Caritas Untitled. And I say without any exaggeration that these books are on many Icelanders' shelves or bedside tables. She took upon herself basically to write the history of like the status of women in modern Icelandic society, and created this amazing world for her character Caritas, who has aspirations to become an artist, a painter, but has to fight against society in order to pursue her calling as an artist. She's pulled this way and that way by society, by the pressure upon her to be married, to have a family, to work on the farm and things like this. And it's an intense struggle, and it's just a wonderful novel, and really was one of, like, showing women in traditional Icelandic society and modern Icelandic society and how they pull together for each other, and also the struggles that they have in realizing themselves as fulfilled individuals or something like that. So poor Caritas, she becomes quite depressed in the novel and has a lot of nightmares, and it's partly because of this tension between her aspirations and society's aspirations for her. So it's a very important book, and also this is the first book of hers that was translated into English, of Kristín Marja's, and hopefully we'll be able to translate the sequel, Chaos on Canvas, and then maybe a few other ones. She has a book, one of her most popular books is called, Seagull's Laughter, and that was made into a film also.
Wonderful. And do you have a reading? Could we hear something from this?
Okay, I'll just read a short passage here. In the middle of the book, when Caritas is pregnant and she's living in the East Fjords. I'll just go into the passage, okay. She waddled down to the co-op and bought coffee, which she herself didn't drink because it made her pulse race and gave her heartburn. But she wanted to have it in her house like a normal person, along with raisins, which she simply couldn't do without. She could eat raisins with a mixture of cream and milk at every meal. In fact, it was all the same to her whether she ate nothing else, and as she wandered home again, she thought about the looks that the women outside the co-op had given her. They weren't the same fleeting glances as before the New Year, but rather longer or even shy gazes, as if she were an important person. She was still wondering about this when someone called to her from a one-story wooden house. It was a young woman with a crowd of children around her. Some of them stood in the doorway, others were out on the steps, and the young woman said, "Good morning, aren't you Sigmar's Caritas?" And Caritas said, "Yes, of course," but found it strange hearing the words Sigmar's Caritas. I'll just leave it at that. That's just a short passage from there. Because this is funny, because another guy in the novel refers to her as a fisherman's wife, and she says, "Fisherman's wife? Why am I identified as Sigmar's Caritas?" Sigmar is her husband. "Why am I identified as a fisherman's wife?" And then when she talks about her art, people are like they don't understand it at all, or why she wants to be an artist. It's really see this tension there. And it's interesting in this particular chapter, which I just read from, later on, you see the community coming together to support Caritas. There's a woman who comes with her daughters and they rush into her house and start making clothing for her and cleaning the house and things like this. And it's this beautiful example of how the community, the women all pull together for each other. And then it also says that people started hanging around the house. Caora was always prowling about. Caritas saw her here and there with a cat on her shoulder. At the sheep shed up on the hill and down by the sea, little boys began frequenting the shore. Adolescent girls sat on the rocks, all positioned so that they could keep an eye on the house. She felt as if she were being kept under constant surveillance, which she was, because the community all wanted to make sure that she was able to give birth safely. And so they all start gathering around the house and making her feel as if she's being spied upon. But it's a wonderfully complex novel. And one of the things about it is that many of the chapters begin with a description of a painting that she's working on. And so it can be very poetic. And also, I know people that have painted the paintings that are described in the book. And I saw a review of Caritas that said, "I'm an artist and Caritas is a work of art." So it's a great novel for anyone interested in Icelandic literature, in art, in that age-old, how do we pursue our art when everything around us is pulling us away from it and things like this. So, and women's history in Iceland.
Great, thank you very much. We've talked a little bit about translation process already, and specifically the challenges that relate to translating Icelandic with its idiosyncrasies into English. We've mentioned that perhaps Icelandic can be a bit, can use some circumlocution in terms of it uses phrases that English might just seek to use a word. And you say there's a lot of idiomatic phrases which are used in Icelandic. Are there any other very specific either phrases or words or characteristics or practices within Icelandic writing that you feel have created interesting challenges for you as a translator?
Yeah, there's one word in Icelandic that's extremely difficult to translate, which is saknuður, which means basically regret, but it can also mean like the pain of bereavement, the pain of loss. It can mean nostalgia. It can mean longing. And one writer that I translate, Jón Kalman Stefánsson, that's one of his favorite things to write about, is this sort of pain of being away from loved ones or longing for the past or something like that. And it's always the same word, saknuður. And it's very difficult to translate with one word. In fact, and one of the most beautiful poems in the Icelandic language is called Saknuður. And it was written by a guy who died very young and who was one of the inspirations for Laxness's own poetic language, one of the early modernist poets in Iceland. Laxness invents words like this Roxemdirheims, which is very difficult to translate with one word. There's another passage in Sakavalka in which he uses language that really struck me and made me pause, stop in my tracks. And there's a scene in which Salka hears like a kind of sing-song noise, and she wonders, she doesn't understand what this is, and she looks over and she sees a woman. It says, I can read this little passage here in English. It says, "She felt as if someone were reading a book without pausing, but when she listened closer, she realized that it wasn't reading, but something more like singing. All at the same volume and with relatively little change in pitch, like the most piteous whining of wind blowing in through a half-open door. It even crossed her mind that her brother might have begun crying somewhere in eternity and in a new manner. What could this be? The girl could not turn a deaf ear to this sing-song." And in Icelandic, Laxness writes that last sentence as "Telpunni var ekki unt að ljá þessu söngli óhljós eiru," which is a very interesting way of saying what I translated, "could not turn a deaf ear to this sing-song," because in Icelandic, literally, it says the girl was not permitted to lend this sing-song an unhearing ear. So Ófljós Eyra, which is just one word. And it's one of those, it's kind of like Laxness has sometimes described as having his own language called Kiljanska after his middle name, Kiljan. And that's one of those Kiljansk-esque words of his, an unsound ear. So you run into that a lot with Laxness. And also he has his own spelling, which is, makes it a little bit more difficult. But yeah, there's a lot of, whether it's a word that sort of encapsulates many different meanings in itself, there are a lot of those in Icelandic, or invented words in Laxness. It's very difficult. So those are just a couple of examples. I have one more. This one of the coolest ways of the way that Oseiri, the village in Sakovaki, is described. It's described as being Ævintýrus nøyð, which means, Ævintýri is another difficult word because it can mean a folk tale, it can mean like a chivalric romance, it can mean an adventure, all these different things rolled into one. And so when Laxness describes Oseiri as being Ævintýrus nøyð, it means adventure deprived. So this is the gray and adventure deprived village, and I think I translated that on this less than epic and unfantastical village, which is what it is. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Summer with Monica, but the way that Bergman portrays Stockholm in that movie is very gray and unfantastical, and even almost nightmarish in that case. So that's another one of those cool. I had to really think about that one. How am I going to translate that?
Yeah, I'm definitely getting a sense of Icelandic as kind of maintaining some of those characteristics and features which English would have had at 1.2, with this kind of, like I said, is using a lot of phrases and a lot of long-winded words that don't really, you can't really express in one word. A lot of compounds and things like this, which a lot of the old kind of Norse and Germanic literature used to do, in which English, due to its contextual history of its development and its evolution, perhaps has moved away from, and the alliteration has given way to the rhyme and all this kind of thing. But yeah, I'm definitely hearing through your, what do you call it, your juxtaposition of the two languages here, how English has changed in the way that Icelandic has perhaps maintained a clearer sense of continuity with some of its old literary forms. Thank you very much for that enlightening discussion. Before we go, are you planning on working on any new translations? Is there anything coming up in the future?
Hopefully I'll be able to do the continuation of Caritas Untitled. Still have to, doing some talking with publishers about that. And there's another Jón Kalman Stefánsson book coming out it should be coming out after the new year, so I finished translating that. In the meantime, I do all kinds of other projects, like translate movie scripts and things like that. So there's always something going on. And there should be another Laxness book coming out, hopefully next year. Yeah, his memoir, or sort of description of where he grew up in the countryside, in Mosfellsbyre, it's called A Parish Chronicle, and hopefully that'll be coming out next year. So plenty to look forward to from the Icelandic literature world.
Wonderful. We look forward to seeing all of that hopefully soon. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This has been Translator from Icelandic, Philip Rotten. Salka Valka by Haldur Laxness is available now from Archipelago Books.
You've been listening to Bowery Poetry Speaks, an audio series of talks and performances with that special Bowery perspective. This series is executive produced by Traffica Europe Radio. Thanks for listening.